Hello?
Arnold Bloom, University of California, Davis.
Okay, so I have Jennifer and Andy and Marion and David and Michael and Jim and Art and Barbara and Kim and Arnold.
Brian Rogan's here.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, Tamara.
Louise Huffman's here.
Hi, Louise.
Hey. Scott Carley's here.
Christine Mills, Carnegie Museum of Natural History.
Frank Niepold, NOAA.
David Rubel, Virginia DEQ.
Okay. All right, well, to all get started, are there any announcements that people would like to make? Anything going on? You'd like to share with anybody?
No, there's nothing going on these days, Tamara.
Nothing going on. So what are you doing, Frank?
Nothing.
Nothing.
I'm waiting for you guys to tell me to do so. No, I've got some interesting things that I need to talk with Queen about from the NSDA meeting, but we can let that go for now.
Okay.
I just spent the last 2 days at the Governor's Climate Summit at the University of California, Davis, and there's quite a diverse group here. Not much being said about education at all, more about how to affect policy.
Who was talking?
Arnold Schwarzenegger, have you ever heard of him?
I'm in right now.
The other Arnold.
Well, this is Caroline from Miami, Florida. I'd like to present Rick Scott to all of you.
Hi, Rick.
He's single-hand. Yeah. Oh, he's gonna be a doozy. Just keep your eye on him.
Yeah. Oh well.
He's a denier. Let's just say he's a denier.
Yeah.
Hi, everybody. It's Laura Tenenbaum.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, Laura.
Hi. I can only stay on the phone for a couple minutes. I actually teach on Tuesday mornings, and I called in from my cell phone on campus today just because, I thought I should say hi to everybody.
Well, we appreciate your call.
Hello. Well.
Hi. Who's that?
That's Scott.
Oh, hi, Scott. Hi. Hi, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Your accent got all of a sudden different.
California is very good.
Yeah. California.
That's the other Arnold.
That's Arnold Bloom.
Good job.
Well, I'm going to be going, this is Tamara, I'm going to be going to a 2.5-day workshop. I'm actually leaving as soon as this call is over to a workshop that will be exploring ways to involve students in climate research projects.
Tamara, you're cutting in and out on us.
Okay, can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be going to basically it's about student-scientist partnerships and identifying pieces of scientific research programs on climate change that students can participate in a meaningful way. So that's where I'm going for the next few days.
Where's that being held?
That's in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Right,
you're going to be going to that too.
Yeah, it's in my building.
Yes, it is.
It's co-funded by NOAA and NSF.
You're listed on the attendee list, Frank.
I am.
You are.
Who was that speaking?
Tamara.
Tamara and Frank Niepold.
Oh, Frank. Hi, Frank. It's Laura.
Hey, Laura. How you doing?
I'm good. Hi.
Okay, are there other activities going on that anybody would like to share before we get started on our presentation for today?
Yeah, this is Barbara Mann from Virginia Space Grant, and I work with NASA Global Climate Change Education, as many of you know. We expect a new solicitation out later this month, maybe around the 22nd, for proposals, and we're target, or NASA is targeting minority-serving institutions, community colleges that may or may not be minority-serving, nonprofits and school systems that have high minority populations. And we're having some workshops. We're having webcast workshops that are actually on-site at 12 sites around the country. You can go to our website. That's gcce.larc.nasa.gov to see where they're being held. And any of you are welcome to come. They're free. And we're hoping, we have our fingers crossed, that this will be a good opportunity to find partnerships. NASA's encouraging new proposers to partner with more mature projects going on out there. So there's an opportunity if something's close to you, or you're welcome to travel, too. You can also catch the webcast at your own personal computer, but then you won't have the added advantage of being able to network with other like-minded people.
What are the dates of these?
I'm sorry, the dates of those are December 3rd and December 6th. The 3rd is the eastern half of the United States, and the 6th is the western half of the United States. But you can pick up the webcast on either of those days.
Barbara, you want to send out an email to the Climate Literacy Network with that URL on it and the date?
She did. She did a beautiful job. This is Caroline. I got it, Barbara. I don't know how I got it, but I signed up for the COCO one in Florida.
Thank you.
I think it's a great opportunity. Go ahead.
Caroline, this is David Blockstein. I'll be down in COCO as well, so I look forward to reconnecting with you.
Wonderful, because the school system and the Miami-Dade College, both very minority-serving institutions, are dying for me to pull together something. So I'm dragging them there with me, and hopefully we can come up with something good.
Very good.
But thank you, Barbara.
Okay, that's good to hear. Should I go ahead and send that again on the CLN?
Yeah, why don't you go ahead,
please?
Yes.
Yeah.
I might just make it simpler with dates and stuff.
Yeah, because I'm looking and on my email right now, and I'm not seeing it.
Okay. I'll do that again.
All right, thank you.
This is Art Sussman from West End. I am principal investigator on one of the recently funded NSF climate change education partnerships. Ours is focused on the U.S.-affiliated Pacific Islands, and we're having our first virtual meeting on Friday, organized by NSF, of all the PIs on the 15 funded projects. And I don't know how many of those projects have been connecting with this network or this SERV.
So your virtual meeting is what date?
Friday.
And this is for your partners that are within this project?
Yeah, this is internal for those that have been funded.
But across all the 15, not yeah, unique to any one individual one.
Right.
Great.
Yeah. Actually, bringing that one, one thing that I think the Climate Literacy Network could play a role in relative to the CSEP grants is you know, I know with West Ed, you know, I've meant to reach out to you because of the Pacific Services Center and the Idea Center, both in Honolulu, and how connected they are with you and the NOAA work. Just as one example, there's many of these that are going on around the country of where there's a project that got funded and there's a lot of other people in that community. So I'm hoping that maybe the Climate Literacy Network can help bridge those gaps as those projects get off the ground.
Who is this?
Frank Niepold at NOAA Climate.
Yeah, hi, Frank. I met you at the conference.
Yep. So
I'm also intending to try to have conversations with each of those new projects to see how we can work together to help bring together assets that might be able to support your effort.
Well, one thing I've been looking at is the work you've been doing in education and built around the science literacy principles that you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that the work you're doing with organizing the curriculum resources and the concepts of that is fine, but my first feeling, and I didn't spend more time with it, is that it would be much more useful to organize those concepts around what's typically taught in the curriculum mm-hmm. rather than around the literacy principles. I mean, it's great to develop them around the literacy principles, but then when you were actually going to be talking with teachers and districts and looking at national standards, I think it'll work much better if it's organized around, you know, the earth science concepts and the overarching ideas and the life science concepts.
Well, actually, the alignment is not complete yet, but they are also going to be aligned with the AAAS benchmarks in science literacy, and Frank has been working on that alignment with the essential principles, so that the identifying resources that address curriculum will be possible.
Right.
I think we aim to do that through the Clean Pathway, and I imagine others are doing similar things. But it's we're 10 months in, and I think that'll start showing up when the strand map service of the NSDL piece of it comes into play. And if it doesn't, then we need to do some work.
Right. So I'm kind of wondering how to get all that more transparent. Like for myself, I'd like to know who's doing that and how
sure.
I can.
Sure.
Plug in so I'm not duplicating effort and I can
absolutely
contribute my expertise.
Yeah, no, I think for that specific thing, you know, if you reach out to Ted Willard or myself and Tamara as the PI, I mean, that'd be the best way to do that for the very near term. There's some there's some things behind the you know, in process that you might find valuable.
Okay, are there any other new people on the phone that would like to introduce themselves?
I'm Louisa Bradmiller from McAllister College. Dan Hornbach is also on the list, but I'm on the call today.
Well, welcome.
Thank
what
you.
Project is that?
This is the CEDD.
Oh, okay.
So.
Yeah. And I'm Michael Nussbaum. I'm with UNLV, the Losing the Light Project. You know, we're developing an educational computer game tied to, it's actually the falling water levels in Lake Mead, as sort of a case study for regional effects of climate change.
Right.
Great.
I'm a new, just signed on myself, I'm Joelle Clark. I work with Northern Arizona University on an NSF-funded climate change grant as well.
Great, well, welcome.
This is Kat Zielinski with University of Maryland, also on a climate change education grant.
Terrific.
And I'm Lynn Harbins of the University System of Maryland. I'm on that same grant.
Great. Well, thank you all for joining us today. Hey, I think if there is no other introductions, then I think we'll move on to our presentation today. The link for the slide is on the website, which I sent out to everybody. And it's the title of the Climate Change Education Modules. And David Blockstein and a larger group, which are going to make this presentation. And David, I'll let you introduce yourself and the rest of your presenters.
Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. So this is one of the NASA Global Climate Change Education Projects. And we are a group of faculty members and colleagues who are organized through the Council of Environmental Deans and Directors, a project of the National Council for Science and the Environment. And I will go through a little bit of what we are. So if you could click onto the second slide, which is the presentation agenda. So I'll make a brief introduction. That will be followed by Andy Jorgensen from the University of Toledo, also a senior fellow with the National Council, talking about our online resources, the Encyclopedia of Earth, and Earth Portal. And then we'll have several people present modules that they developed with the NASA funding. David Kitchen from University of Richmond, David Hassenthal, and we're not all named David, from Chatham University in Pittsburgh, and also a a visiting fellow with NCSC. Patricia Minster of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, one of Dave's graduate students, and Arnold Bloom from University of California, Davis, and then Tim Weston, our evaluator, will talk about evaluation tools, and Andy Jorgensen finally will moderate any discussion that's available. So if you turn to the third slide, you can see what I used to look like when I had more hair on my face. And my email address for follow-up. So quickly, the National Council is a 20-year-old non-governmental organization with a focus on bringing individuals and organizations together to develop solutions to connect science with decision-making on environmental issues. And the project is an example of the way that we work in a collaborative fashion, and the fact that we've brought a number of people from new universities into the project or into the webinar today, I think is also an example. So we have our Council of Environmental Deans and Directors on slide 5, which is the leaders, environmental leaders at the 170 or so universities that we work with. And this project is one that came out of the Council of Environmental Deans and Directors as a need for developing curriculum for colleges and universities, especially for, in this case, for general students, general education students. And I think you'll see that they're also probably similar uses for senior high school students, because there isn't really that much difference between a general ed student and a senior high school student in a lot of ways. So, as I mentioned on slide 6, this project that we call the NASA NCSE Interdisciplinary Climate Change Education Project is funded through the NASA Global Climate Change Education funding. On slide 7, so our goal is to develop curriculum for general education, and the components that we'll be describing are based on resources from NASA principally, and our goal is experiential education, using those resources for students to do their own education in the context of a classroom or online education. And so this is on slide 8, just an example of some of the NASA resources that we use: Landsat images, data on temperature and precipitation, and a very cool thing called the Climate Time Machine, which you will learn about soon. I also want to mention that this is part of a larger project that we have funded by NSF, the Climate Adaptation and Mitigation e-learning project, or CAMEL, and CAMEL is a project to create a learning community of educators developing educational resources for climate change, sharing them, improving them, and the NASA project is, if you pardon the term here, is our camel's nose under the tent, our first funded project, and these resources will become the first component of the CAMEL project. So I will now turn to Andy Jorgensen on slide 10, and Andy still does have his big beard. Go ahead, Andy.
Thank you. Trust you can all hear me okay. I'm going to talk about two aspects of the NCSE that we're utilizing significantly for this project. On slide 11, you'll see the parallel columns for the two online resources. One is the Encyclopedia of Earth, which is a peer-reviewed online encyclopedia available to the web like anything else. It's wiki-based. We have over 1,000 contributors, almost 6,000 articles right now. We just had an upgrade about a month ago. You'll see the visual in just a minute. It has encyclopedia articles, but also collections and curricula, and it has the material we're talking about for this project. The Earth Portal is a more dynamic in which groups can self-assemble and use material from the Encyclopedia of Earth or other places to carry out their project, whatever it might be. And we have a portal strictly for educators using the Encyclopedia of Earth and one for students. It's the software behind it is by Trinity, going to the 12th slide here. They have an online platform that supports not just this project but other projects. And if interested, you can set up your own portal through it. At the very end, I'll give my email address again, and I'll be happy to walk any of you through anything for the Encyclopedia of Earth or the Earth Portal. The portal is, as I say, more dynamic. People can be authors and post things automatically, whereas the Encyclopedia of Earth does require referees to review the article. On 13, let's describe what we have on the Encyclopedia of Earth for this project. We have the eight parts of, the central part of seven of the modules, the contents and the presentations, and then links to encyclopedia articles to support it. And this, of course, is totally accessible, no limitations, whereas the Porta does have some limitations for teachers, for example. Slide 14 is a screenshot. You can see the URL on the bottom. You don't need to remember that. If you just go to the Encyclopedia of Earth, which is eoearth.org, and type in the words NASA, you'll come to the list of the various modules, and then this is the introductory page of the modules. You'll see on the Encyclopedia of Earth on the left are our 20-some major topics, climate change being up there in the third part. This particular introduction written by David, I'm going to go down the screen a little bit and see those are the hot links to the particular modules, three of which you're going to see today, and the information about the people who wrote them. So these two screens are the Encyclopedia of Earth, publicly available to everybody. The next is the Earth Portal, which, as I say, has more background material and is a more dynamic nature and can be limited. We have a portal for this project. You can then create your own portal if you want or use that portal. This is slide 16 I'm on. You can create a sub-portal in ours to use the same material, and anything from the Encyclopedia of Earth can be pulled into, actually just linked, into your portal, so even if there's updates to the modules, they'll automatically be available on whatever, you know, the Earth Portal is your little, your workspace. Going to slide 17, you see the image of the portal, and it has, again, along the left, the columns, but as they say, this is more dynamic. Anybody can look at this, but to enter it, you need to be a member, and I can line you up to be a member. You'll see a small list of the members along the right. And this, as they say, is background materials, like you'll see featured Kevin Spiegel, one of our module writers. There's his bio. He's at Unity College. So this is the portal component of it, which has made it to be quite super. Number 18, we also have a dedicated student community portal in which which you can direct your students to, and they can freely post comments. They just have to generate a username, and in fact, in the future, they'll be able to do this through with their Facebook username. It'll be connected with Facebook in that way, so they can post comments and cross-post back and forth. And students here can communicate with students at other institutions and say, well, I just finished the ICE Core module, and this is what I thought, or the one in Colorado River. And if you want, you can generate a sub-portal for this one so only your students get on it. So a lot of flexibility here, and again, we're happy to help you through this. This is on 18. That's just a list of some of the features of what we can do on this student portal, student-to-student communication. That's on 19.
Yep. All right, cool.
Number 20, introduction to specific modules. I'll be back at the end of the call, but now I'm going to introduce David Kitchen, he's written a couple of the modules, and he'll take it from here, from slide 21. David?
All right, let's just see if the sound works okay. Everybody hear me okay?
Yep.
Yes.
Yes.
All right, well, you can certainly click past the picture of me and go on to page 22, or slide 22. What we're basically doing, I guess, today is starting chronologically in the sense that the module that I prepared looked back in time at historical data, and they're there to support courses that look at this historical data running through to the present day and trying to see how that helps us to predict future climate and how it can inform us about the likely rates of climate change and basically how what we see happening today compares to what we know has happened in the past. Students, first of all, when they look at the data, tell me it looks like hard stuff, and I've just had 30 students go through this process, so we know it's not that hard stuff at the end. They all did very well. And the background to it is that when I was showing lots of diagrams of ancient climate and these trends that we can see in sea level and temperature, that students weren't really looking at these diagrams. They were looking through them. They weren't seeing them. They weren't really understanding them. So the purpose of these exercises was to get the students to work with the data directly. And to cut a long story short, it soon became clear that that wasn't going to be easy to do unless I simplified it somewhat, brought the data together, made it readily accessible to the students. So if we go on to the next slide, then it's 23. So the topics I've covered, I've basically broken it down into ocean core data, ice core data, and then sort of more modern historical data. I tended to look at sea levels as determined from backstripping of sediment cores, and temperature largely based on, of course, on foraminifera tests. The ice core data, of course, again, based on oxygen isotope data, along with looking at the, you know, the gas content trapped within the ice cores and other things such as dust. Then the historical data is just looking at a range of historical data, both, of course, land and ocean surface temperatures, solar data, astronomical data, particularly focusing, of course, on Milankovitch cycles and using those to predict the future as well as understanding how they control the past. And then, to some degree, but not so much, looking at natural cycles, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, the North Atlantic Oscillation, those factors which are used by climate skeptics to obfuscate the issues these days. I think students should understand those and understand them in the right context. So the next slide, then, is, 24? It's just an example. That those of you seeing it larger, it's a little blurry, and I apologize for that. It was taken from a PDF that I did. All these slides are originally on spreadsheets, and the students have access to the real data on spreadsheets, so they can see themselves and see how they work for themselves. This is just, as I say, an example showing some how sea level has changed, and most of you probably will be more than familiar with this and be able to interpret that for yourselves in terms of just what has happened over the last couple of million years. This shot, again, is one of the graphs, and again, just emphasize that the students have the original data, so I really require them to draw these themselves and even to focus in certain areas. Looking at the period of time since the last interglacial period, if you look closely, you'll see it's somewhat warmer than today. And showing how the climate has generally cooled over the last 8,000 years, but particularly looking at these Damsgaard Oeschler cycles, these little interstadial periods and stadial incursions that took place during the last glacial advance, and how we can relate those to climate, how we can relate those to changes in the oceans. The next one here on slide 26, looking at sunspot data, and trying to relate, allow students to understand that, yes, the sun is important. It is out there in the sky, and it has a big control on climate, and how we can relate past climate change to changes in the sun, and yet through that understand that the sun today is not having enough of an impact on climate to explain the warming that we're seeing. Again, one of the canards which is often thrown out by climate skeptics. In terms of the overall pedagogy in the last minute, each module has an aim, introduction, learning outcomes, and then, of course, the exercises. I have sample answers which aren't yet posted, but I have available for anybody who wants them, and some suggestions to faculty teaching this of some added value, how they can extend this beyond the actual immediate content of the module. In terms of books, Arnold's book is, of course, there already. Mine, I'm promised by the publisher, should be out in the spring, but anybody who needs more background data on teaching this, I'm happy to help them with this. Then finally, slide 28, use the modules, and basically they're here to support somebody who's already teaching a course which is looking at ancient climate. I hope everybody does look at ancient climate, because we can't really understand what's happening today without understanding what happened in the past. And again, it's to introduce students to real data, so they have to get, you know, down and dirty with the data rather than just looking at it as a pretty draft screen. And so much of what happens today in the media and among the skeptics is related to obfuscating the data, so the students need to understand, exactly what where that data is coming from. And my 5 minutes is up, so thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions, of course.
And you'll see on 29, David Hassenzell and Tricia Munster on climate change impacts on the Colorado River water supply. Are you starting, David, and then Tricia's going? Is that right? That is on 29.
Tricia, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. I think I'll just, I just want to make one quick comment on David's, which is, he said these data are available to students. I just looked, those data are available to anyone at the Encyclopedia Earth site. But Tricia has been teaching this recently, so I'm going to let her just go ahead with it.
Yeah, and I would just like to also add, as far as David Kitchen's modules, we did use those in class, and I am not a geologist. Admittedly, I had to use some of his sample answers, but I found them very helpful, especially as companions to the Arnold Bloom book, with regards to students actually looking at how the proxies work. So it's not very complicated.
Thank you.
Beyond that, we also did a module that I designed using the Colorado River watershed as an example of local impacts from climate change. Starting on slide 30, you can see it's some NASA satellite images that we use predominantly in this module, just looking at the course of the river and the landscape that it's going through. So again, highlighting that this is an arid section of the country where water is a precious resource to begin with, so losing that water that's already scarce is something that the students can readily understand. And then cruising through the slides, 31 just gives a breakdown of the allocation of the river water. So to remind the students that in Las Vegas, obviously they see Lake Mead, they know the river's coming through, and that not all of that water is theirs, although I think there's a certain underlying assumption that Lake Mead does belong to Las Vegas in their own heads, but reminding them that this is a interdependent system with a finite amount of water in it, and every drop of that water is pretty much accounted for. So there's the breakdown of the allocations there, and you can actually see that Nevada gets the smallest portion of it, and all of that does go to Las Vegas. Slide 32 shows a graph. It's a very simple graph from the data set that they get as part of the module, so they can look at the raw data that we get, and it's specifically to the snowpack in Colorado Rockies goes towards the Colorado River Basin. So this is very specific to the river that's flowing through. And the first part is to stop and look at this graph and work through it with the students. As David Kitchen mentioned, I think there's a lot of value in having the students interpret the graphs and understand what it means to work with the data and what kind of interpretations you get. So we use this just to make sure, one, they understand what the graph is saying. So do they understand that this is a percentage of average snowpack, and what does that mean? The 100 represents 100% average, so that is the average. And anything over 100 is above average. Anything below 100 is below average. And then we go through and ask them a bunch of questions as far as, there's an obvious outlier for June of 95. It was a 325% average of the snowpack. So that's actually indicative of a weather event or an error in the data collection, that's an outlier, that does not necessarily, it does not prove climate change. So just kind of working through and making sure they understand what it means to have a trend in the data.
Can I ask a question second on this?
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Is it the snow or is it some other measure?
I'm sorry, you were breaking up.
Is the average snowpack, is that the thickness of the snow, or is it some other index?
You know what? I believe the way it's calculated is it's the thickness as well as the extent.
Okay.
And it's accumulation of snow stations and other types of snow measuring stations. So it was already compacted into snowpack by the time I got the data.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So we worked through the data with that, and there is just a clear trend at about 20 years through the data. There's definitely more snow that's falling in the beginning of the data set than in the last 20 years. So we also worked through the idea that if you assume that that's just an extended drought, it leads to certain climate or certain policy decisions, and that this is an indication of climate change, it leads to other policy decisions. So discussing that with the students. Moving past that, slide 33 is again, just a simple demonstration of where we store the water for the river, but the change, so if we're getting less snow, then there's going to be less water in the river, water in our reservoirs. And then slide 34, 35, and 36 actually demonstrate that with some of our NASA satellite images, clearly demonstrating that there is less water in the reservoir that hold that water for the seven states.
Trisha, on 34 there, you pointed out before about in 2000, Saddle Island was an island, and in 2003 it's no longer an island. it's totally connected to the land.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then slide 36 shows the same thing takes out, which is the other major storage for the river. And then after we've established that there's less water in the entire river, reminding students that, again, this means that all seven states are experiencing that lack of water, we talk about who's using the water for what, the different purposes. So slide 37 brings us to agriculture, especially agriculture in an arid environment. What you're seeing there are satellite images of the Imperial Valley in Southern California and the All-American Canal that brings water from the Colorado River to the Imperial Valley, which is clearly in the middle of the desert. But it's one of the most productive agricultural regions in the country, let alone the world. It's extremely intensive agricultural production. So less water going to that has some our extent. Slides 38 and 39 talk about urban development and the increased demand for energy. To bring energy to that, as well as the fact that as more coal plants are proposed in these states, there's a feedback loop as far as producing coal requires a lot of water, but it also then feeds back into the climate change mechanism that reduces the amount of water available. And then slides 40 and 41 talk about the fact that some of that allocation goes to Mexico, but it never meets the needs for agriculture in that valley that the river would typically drain through. And so what that means with regards to international and non-human communities. So this is actually meant to be an adaptation and mitigation exercise. After already working through the science of climate change, this is what we use as kind of a wrap-up on adaptation and mitigation options and lead into our policy and legal discussions. So that's kind of the quick for that. Are there questions?
Yeah, this is Jane Molson from Towson. I didn't say hello earlier, but as I'm looking at these maps, I'm just a bit confused as to the lack of labels on them. If you study it, you know it, but if you don't study it, if you're used to looking at the bay,
that's a valid point. These are actually images that were pulled off of a PowerPoint that was pulled off this thing. If you go to the Encyclopedia of Earth to actually download the module from their website,
it's there.
It comes down in full documents with background knowledge, labels, where we get the pictures and the images from. So the full knowledge and the labels actually come with the document when you go to Encyclopedia of Earth.
Okay, that's to solve it.
Everything you see today is available on the Encyclopedia of Earth. And more, as Tricia said.
Yeah, and I'd also like to point out, we use it in Vegas. It's obviously very pertinent to our area, but for our seven states that rely on this water, it makes it incredibly relevant to any of those seven states or any state where you share water with some other major metropolitan area.
And as David Blackstein said at the beginning, we have NASA Landsat images for 27 areas around the country. That's those 27 were selected by institutions which are part of our partners. And then we have the data in 1975, 85, 95, and 2005. And they're the false color images to look at foliage and other things. And this data can all be downloaded. If you want to download it, talk to me ahead of time because they're very large files. But you can download for any of those 27 areas, any or all, as well as a national map. So moving on to 42, the other Arnold from California, Arnold Bloom, take it away.
Hello. Slide 42 shows me in all my glory. My name is Bloom. I am a botanist, and I decided that we needed to have something on biology and the consequences of climate change on biology. It's pretty hard, if you're a botanist, it's pretty hard to fight polar bears. And so I tried to pick the most charismatic plant that I could, and the wine grapes seemed to fill the bill. And if you look at wine grapes, there's an aura about this, and you can go from, if you go on to the next slide, 43, you can go from a bottle of wine that's sold for almost $34,000 to the kind of wine that I buy from Trader Joe's, which goes for $2 a bottle. And and obviously that disparity has to do with the quality of the wine grapes that go into it as with manufacturing. If you look at the raw materials, this is a map of California on slide 44. Premium wine grapes are produced in a narrow climatic range that lacks both extreme heat and extreme cold. So if you buy from the Napa Valley, we're right next to the Napa Valley. And if you buy, and you'll see where we are in just a moment, but it's pointed out on this map that grapes from Napa Valley go for $5,400 a ton. The same grapes grown further south in the San Joaquin Valley, also labeled there, go for $270 a ton. So there's a 20-fold difference in price. And I know all of you out there have dreams of owning your own vineyard. And this is an exercise that you want to do to determine whether where you should locate your vineyard, if that is a wine quality is a criteria that you'll be using in selecting your site. I took as a test case a longitudinal gradient from California that hit some major spots that are pretty much at the same latitude. Davis, you can see here in slide 45, is just to the east of Napa. Colfax is in the foothills of California, and then Fort Bragg, actually this got shifted. Actually, Fort Bragg is on the coast. They should be all shifted a little bit to the, I don't know how this happened, but yeah. If you put all those red dots to the where it makes Fort Bragg on the coast, then everything will be accordingly shifted, and the red grid is where Davis is. So there is NASA data having temperature records and precipitation records for the last 50 years or longer for each of these sites, and so we started looking at it. To evaluate the wine quality and the desirability of growing grapes there, we used this slide 46. You'll see Mr. Winkler, Dr. Winkler, who was a member of our viticulture and enology department here at Davis, and he had a way of determining the desirability of premium wine grape production in a particular area, dealing with degree days. If you don't know what degree days are, you can go through the exercise and become very expert on this. Next slide, 47. In fact, there are, he defined things as four grape growing areas. Region 1 is okay. Region 2 and 3 are really the prime places where you get your $5,500 a ton for grapes. And then you go into the places where I live, where you have inferior table wines and makes low-quality table wines. So I looked at the trends at the various. If you look at satellite data, which actually takes the whole grid, you really get nonsense. And so it says that the ocean is almost an ideal place. Davis is okay, and the foothills are okay, and Napa is terrible. So it doesn't make any sense, and we'll explain why that is in a moment, but having the students go through this is useful. There are spreadsheets where they can go through these data, or they can go to the original sources of data and pick any place in the United States and decide whether they should put their winery there. If you do the actual sites of the various places that the various cities and the local weather stations not using satellite data, you get much more reasonable results, and you can see how the trends have changed over the last 60 years at each of these sites. In fact, Napa is becoming less and less premium area. The foothills, because they're getting warmer with the change that has already occurred, are becoming much more desirable for premium grape production. In fact, that's where most of the new wineries are opening in California. The ocean's way too cold, and you can't grow anything there. And Davis has always been too hot, and it's getting hotter, and therefore we can grow your rock gut if you so desire to drink it. Okay. Some of the take-home messages are that satellite data is too coarse to make very detailed explanations about what's happening on the ground. I show this in the slide 51 is that essentially this is a grid where we would have the actually site data, and you can actually see someone there fully clothed. But if you do an extrapolation over the entire grid as the satellite data does, then there's essentially no details, and it makes it the data much more less discernible. So satellite data, spatial slide 52, spatial resolution's too low, time scale's too short. You can look at this explanation of satellite data and its shortcomings in terms of agricultural production at this particular paper that's cited here. Ground data, year-to-year variation obscures trends. Students have to learn how to do some averaging and some running averages as one way to expose trends, and that there is a climate change that is already affecting where premium grape production has occurred and will occur. Thank you.
Yay.
And everybody likes the wine topic. And
oh, yeah.
On slide 53, our last presenter, Tim Weston, University of Colorado at Boulder. He's our evaluator and has created some tools that that we use and anyone can use. I'll set it up for you. So, Tim, you want to take your second
sure.
here from 53?
Not sure who that guy is. He looks pretty handsome, but it's not me. That's funny. Okay.
Who is it, Tim?
I don't know. Somebody put that picture on there. Does anybody know that guy? Huh. Okay, well, slide 54. Again, this is Tim Weston. I'm from the University of Colorado in Boulder. We're looking at, this is kind of a fairly bare budget, kind of bare bones evaluation. Purposes for assessment really have to do, we're looking at student attitudes before and after they take courses or modules, and if they change from pre to post, and if students understand specific topics around global warming and after completing the modules. And slide 55, some assessment instruments which are online. We have an attitude instrument, has 14 agree, disagree attitude questions. Things like, I believe people should change their lifestyles to help minimize climate change. Five self-assessment questions, just how well-informed are you about different topics around that. And two previous experience questions, just finding out how familiar students are with what kind of classes they've taken, and if they've changed personal behaviors related to climate change.
Tim, can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
This is Frank Niepold at NOAA. Did you guys, I imagine the timing on this was off, but the America's Knowledge of Climate Change work that Yale completed through an NSF, I'm sure you're aware of it.
Yes.
But one of the things we've been exploring on a lot of different fronts is the commonality of questions and uh-huh. the intercomparison of some of them. Did you guys look at that?
Or yeah, I looked at that one, and I don't know. There's probably five or six other ones
right.
going on.
But did you use some of those questions exactly?
We probably did. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it would be interesting just to see how those are work.
Yeah, we have some limitations with how much time and kind of we can have with the students, so we have to boil down some of these.
Right. The only reason I ask is because, I mean, one of the things we're looking at NOAA is whether or not the America's knowledge of climate change can establish a baseline for contribution analysis on a lot of these activities. That's part of what the discussion at the roundtable was about, is how are all these activities adding up together in some way in citizen attitude and understanding and knowledge. But anyway. Because
thanks for that question, Frank.
Yeah.
You and I should follow up on that.
Yeah. There's actually several instruments out there, but most of them are longer is the problem.
Well, the reason why I brought this up, and I'm pushing this point one bit further, is that at the roundtable, Tony's one of his key points was that the most knowledgeable Six America was the dismissives. They got the most knowledge questions right.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the most alarmed yeah. got the least amount. They were willing to accept it. They were willing to move on it. They were willing
yeah.
to do things about it, but they knew the least about it.
Actually, it's different in this data finding that.
Yeah, that's great.
The other way. So.
Really? That's incredibly important. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sure.
We're just starting. These are all students in non-science major introductory college classes. So
it might be a different population. That's true. Right. Okay. So there's also 10 content knowledge questions. This is slide 56. For instance, just over the last century, global average temperatures have, you know, cooled, warmed. And questions used for these questions are used for pre-assessment, and we compare with specific questions on the post. Also, just it's a good way to kind of sort students.
Hello, this is Barbara Mann.
Hi.
Was someone calling for me?
Somebody getting a tone on the phone.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Just got an email from her. Okay. The assessments are all online through SurveyMonkey, and each institution has their own version of the assessments, and the results are sent to the faculty after the administration. Basically, you just need to talk to send me an email, and I set it up for you. Human subjects, students' responses are anonymous and they're used in aggregate, so students don't need to fill out informed consent. And most institutions will honor the approval that's been granted from the University of Toledo, and we'll send a letter to each participating institution. If you just use it for your own purposes, you don't need to get human subjects approval. Here's an example of some results from Toledo. You can kind of see, whoops, I just pressed the wrong button. You can see, you know, a histogram of how many people agreed, that kind of thing. And here's the links if you need to go to the attitude or content instrument, and also please contact me again if you want to set up your own link. Thanks.
So 61.
Are these links to take the survey or just to see what the questions are?
You can do both.
Okay.
So if you just
If you want to do the survey yourself again, you get your own link basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
So with anybody just stumbles upon it or you look at it, we're not collating that data because we don't know where it's from, but you send a note to Tim and then he'll set up the last digits will be different for your institution, and there are the content and attitude pre, and then the same questions will be post, but then we have separate assessments for each of the individual modules, the David Kitchens, the Arnold Blooms, the David
right.
Hirsch. So you tell us which ones that you use.
Yeah, I think I missed some. A slide here.
We have them on specific modules.
Okay, yeah, 57.
On 62, you'll see the list of our other partners, Kevin Spiegel, Unity College in Maine. He's in class right now, so couldn't tell us. He has some excellent modules on, again, the more geological end of these things. He, in fact, went in and got some additional NASA data for his area and got a couple weeks' worth of activity in his class. Marcia Owens is interested in the social sciences. You'll see her material on the portal rather than the website at this point, social impacts of climate change, and Mary Benedict, Texas El Paso, and Maggie Service, a graduate student working with us, and Susan Usted at University of California, Davis. She was she and a graduate student who actually did all the NASA data. She's a NASA expert. And the last slide, 63, is my name and phone number and email. I'm ready to help you out, walk you through any of this, and get you set up with any part of using it in your courses. If you have a course started in January, that would be an absolutely perfect time for you to use any or all of these modules. And we're really recruiting groups to beta test it this year, this spring, and then in the summer we'll more broadly release it. So any questions, comments?
Yeah, this is Andy Negri at the University of Maryland. I just had a comment on Professor Bloom's portion of the talk. I don't know if you're aware, but my boss here at the Earth System Science Interdisciplinary Center is a guy named Tony Bussolacci, and in addition to being a professor of climate science, He's a sommelier who is, I think, rated at the top 10% of those in the world. And he's put together a really fabulous PowerPoint on climate change and wine production, which I'd be, with his permission, make available to you.
That's great. There is also there's been other studies. There's obviously a lot of concern in the wine industry about these changes, but there was a study in PNAS that came out in 2006 by AHO where they did predict shifts in the major premium wine growing areas in the United States and how California was going to be left behind and we were going to move to Maine.
What I remember about his talk is he included a significant amount of data from Europe as well.
Good deal. You know, there's a lot of interest there, and I think that it could be for those people with those interests that there is a wealth of material.
Other questions or comments?
Okay, well, this is Tamara. Thanks a lot. This presentation has been recorded, and the slides are there, so anybody can listen to it again, or those people who have not are on the phone. I did get a few emails from people who wanted to call in but didn't manage to do that. So anyway, so thank you very much for your presentation. If there are no other questions or comments.
Yeah, actually, Tamara, let me just say one thing. This is David Blockstein, and that is that, first, thanks again for the opportunity to do this. And as part of our project with NASA, you know, we are interested in knowing who is using the modules, if they are using them in their teaching, as well as if you're going to use them, then we can help you with the assessment tools. So please do contact any of us, but especially Andy, for general, just let us know, you know, you're going to be using this in your teaching, and we can give you any sort of help that you need, because our goal really is to use this to expand knowledge and engage students, and so we want to see how we're doing.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
It's being recorded, and will the recording be on the website? They can just link on it, because I've had also a couple people say they're interested more.
Yes. Well, it'll get emailed to me sometime today, and between today and tomorrow it'll be posted right where the agenda is, where the slides are.
Thank you.
One other question for David, as in Blockstein. The Council of Environmental Deans and Directors, I mean, do they play a role in the dissemination part of this equation? It would be very interesting.
Yes, and that's...
What I'm specifically getting at is it would be very interesting to know at the undergraduate and potentially graduate level how much of this type of work is actually going on within, and I would think the Council of Environmental Deans and Directors would be, you know, able to help with that. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, and we did a workshop at our SED meeting when we met at NCAR this summer, and there are, and then we've done a couple of webinars for SED people, and I think there are at least a half a dozen, and maybe considerably more people that are on the webinar today, on the conference call today, because of the connection with the SED network, and so now we need to collect and see who's actually doing what.
Right. Thank you.
Very good. All right. Thank you very much, everybody.
We will
have our call again next week, and we'll talk to you then.
That's great.
Thanks, all.
Bye-bye. And next week we have Carol and Luke talking to us.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.